Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Imagine a safe place where Wilmington teens could go after school to learn, exercise, relax, and socialize. A collaboration of nonprofit organizations with a lot of input from teens themselves is trying to make it a reality. Contributor Larry Nightingale tells us more about this project. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also conclude our series of candidate conversations in the state treasurer's race, hearing from the Green Party's candidate, David Chandler. Plus, our arts playlist has a look at a new season of music from Mila Mani. And this week's Enlighten Me tells us what DelDOT is doing to help suicide prevention in the first state. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In recent years, a variety of plans, initiatives, and programs have been floated to help Wilmington youth cope with and overcome serious issues facing the state's largest city. Issues like violence, struggling schools, and finding work. A new one focuses on those in their teen years, and while still on the drawing board, has already garnered substantial commitments of support. It's called Teen Warehouse, and it envisions giving city teenagers a safe place to go after school to learn, keep fit, relax, and socialize. Contributor Larry Nightingale takes a look at this proposed teen sanctuary in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he sat down with me this week to share what he discovered.
Well, let's start with the concept itself. What is the Teen Warehouse supposed to be and supposed to accomplish?
Okay, it's supposed to be a safe place, a place where teenagers from Wilmington can go after school in the evening so that they're off the streets and that they're in a nonviolent environment. And it'll be more than just a place to hang out. It would offer a range of programming that interests teens and meets their needs. Recreation, academic support, information about health and nutrition, spaces to paint, sing, or learn computer coding, and to get advice about careers and college choices.
So who's behind this idea, and what was the impetus for its creation?
Okay, a lot of people, really a whole lot of people, are behind the project. But the driving force is Logan Herring, who is the executive director of the Kingswood Community Center, which is in the Riverside neighborhood in the northeast part of the city. As for the impetus, first note that in the last 10 years or so, maybe even longer than that, the emphasis on youth programs both in Delaware and in the various communities throughout the state has been on the preschool and the elementary school populations. Teenagers, especially those in that 13 to 16 age group, they've tended to fall between the cracks. And they're at a very difficult, vulnerable age. They're too young to get a job. You don't necessarily want them being home alone. I mean, you're 12, 13 years old. They're vulnerable to making inappropriate decisions if they're out on the streets, if they don't have any sort of adult supervision.
And part of what makes this different is essentially it's not a top-down concept, right? Teens are actively being engaged to help develop it. How are they doing that?
Well, exactly. To figure out what the teen warehouse ought to be offering on its menu, Herring and the other project organizers hired two groups of high school students to spend a good part of the summer doing some brainstorming. Now, some of these youngsters had been participants in the innovative dual school project that we've talked about on previous occasions. So they've had experience working on projects, developing their own ideas, testing them out. The others were part of the Delaware Futures Program, which provides mentoring and other supports to lower-income students who could benefit from a little extra help and guidance as they prepare for college. Anyhow, these teens came up with ideas that they thought should be emphasized: health and nutrition topics, job shadowing to help with career readiness, creating a welcoming environment so it would be a place that their peers would want to be at, a place where kids really want to go, where they can learn some things, where they can have fun, where they can really feel at home.
Having said that, what is the plan? What do they think the Teen Warehouse will look like and include when it's finished? And also, where do they expect it to be?
Well, let's do the and where first. Herring's original thought was to acquire a warehouse near the Kingswood Community Center. And that's how Teen Warehouse got its name. But as the plans developed, he realized that they would probably need more space than that particular warehouse had available. Now, within about a mile from Kingswood is the two-story building that was once occupied by Prestige Academy, a charter school that shut down 2 years ago. The school's operators had stopped making payments on their mortgage, so the building is now owned by Capital One Bank. Teen warehouse organizers have asked Capital One to donate the building to them, and they've already drawn up plans for dividing the building into classrooms, open areas, and offices. Now, I've been told that the outstanding mortgage on the building was in the neighborhood of $3 million. It's understandable, then, that Capital One might be looking for a buyer before deciding to take that big a write-off. And in any event, it could be 6 months before the site issue is resolved. I've also been told that Teen Warehouse's board does have a backup site in mind. So now let's go back to the first part of your question. What will it look like? Well, components would include a big lounge area for socializing, a gym for sports and recreation, a computer lab, a library and reading room, a STEM room for science and technology projects, several classrooms that can be adapted for diverse uses. Also under consideration for the site would be a health clinic. So a lot of different things that would help serve the needs of teens and keep them interested and hopefully make them want to go back.
And the idea is also to make this kind of a hub for a variety of groups that have showed success with what they do, offering these different opportunities, I guess more or less on a revolving basis, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's really fascinating about this project. You know, there are a lot of groups in and around Wilmington that have successful programs for young people. Boys and Girls Clubs, Christina Cultural Arts Center, community centers like Kingswood and the West End Neighborhood House. And there are a lot of other organizations like Delaware Futures, Light, Teen Sharp, Coded by Kids. Dual School is looking for a permanent place, too. The idea here is not for these programs to necessarily locate in Teen Warehouse, but rather that they would bring their people in and offer the things that they do best. Tutors from West End Neighborhood House, for example, college planning workshops from Delaware Futures, advice on health care and health issues from the University of Delaware, things like that. So a lot of these community resources would drop in, establish a little bit more than a drop-in presence, but they'd be in and out and meeting the needs of the teens who are participating in the program.
And while this big concept obviously remains a work in progress, some of the ideas are getting a bit of a test drive now. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, again, I can't tell you a whole lot. The details are still being finalized. I think, one thing we haven't mentioned here is this teen warehouse concept is, they say a year away. It'd be next September, October, when it would start. And that's going to require everything to go well and fall into place. But anyhow, right now, they're finalizing some details for a pilot program. There are two charter schools in the community education building downtown that enroll students in 6th through 8th grade, Kumba Academy and Great Oaks Charter. Teen Warehouse now has rented some space in the community education building and is putting together a pilot program that would provide supports to about 15 students from each of those schools. Some of the students who worked on the planning and programming over the summer for Teen Warehouse would serve as mentors in this pilot program. Now, again, not sure what it might include, but you could expect that they'd be offering things like STEM projects, like art projects, team building exercises, and then maybe bringing in people from programs like Teen Sharp and Delaware Future to talk about career choices and how to prepare for high school and college, that sort of thing.
It seems that this project has gathered momentum in part because it's got some pretty substantial support. Can you give us a sense of just how wide the support for this is right now?
Okay, well, for starters, the state included $1 million in its current budget. In theory, that's supposed to be for capital costs, equipment, renovations, and so on. But, more likely, some of that money is going to be used in a broader sense for a range of these startup expenses. Teen Warehouse has also applied for a grant from the Longwood Foundation, whose president is Thayer DuPont, who happens to be a board member of the Pete DuPont Freedom Foundation, named after Thayer's father. And the Freedom Foundation had previously arranged for support for Teen Warehouse when it was in its very early planning stages. In other words, you put those pieces together, it's reasonable to expect that there's going to be a substantial grant from the Longwood Foundation. And now when Longwood gives its blessing to a project, it's likely that other foundations and businesses will follow suit. Another big reason to be optimistic is the number of partners teen warehouses already lined up. The city, United Way, multiple nonprofits and community centers. Teen Warehouse is also in the process of talking with the officials at multiple state agencies, Department of Education, Labor Department, Children's Department, Health and Social Services, to assess needs and potential partnerships.
This seems like a pretty massive project. Is there any concern that instead of being too big to fail, it could actually be too big to succeed? Not just in getting started, but maintaining it, especially financially.
I think you're absolutely right on both fronts. It's in some respects too big to succeed and too big to fail. I mean, so much hinges right now on acquiring that Prestige Academy building and getting it renovated. I mean, I'm hearing it may take Capital One 6 months to make a decision. Even if they decide to make the decision and make the building available by the end of this year, that still leaves only 8 or 9 months to get it ready in time for next fall. So in other words, while the goal may be to have teen warehouse operating a year from now, it could easily take 2 years to get it started. You know, and it's fair to wonder, if there are delays, does that create more time for planning, or does it slow the momentum that's building for the project? Funding, is of course going to be an issue. I mean, they've got a very detailed financial template lined up, but of course it is dependent significantly on getting grants from the businesses, from the foundations, on being able to rent some of the space and these various partnerships. There are a lot of ifs there, but I mean that doesn't mean it's necessarily a negative. It means that there are a lot of things that have to come together. Now look, there's good reason here though to be optimistic. I mean, you're getting teens involved in making these decisions, and we've got some really very talented and very energetic 30-somethings that are carrying the ball here. Perhaps they're trying to do too much, but quite frankly, it's better to aim high than not do enough.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. Again, his piece on the planned teen warehouse in Wilmington is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt tells us about the Delaware Division of Human Relations efforts to make more housing providers aware of fair housing laws and what they mean to them. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Housing providers in Newcastle County learned how to better respect the rights of their tenants and residents this week during a fair housing workshop held by the State Division of Human Relations. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt has more on how the division fights housing discrimination in the first state.
Ramona Fulman is director for the Division of Human Relations. She says Tuesday was a basic fair housing workshop.
Fair housing 101, as we call it, and it was open to the public. And so when people are parties to a case, they are advised when there's public sessions for them to learn, and then sometimes we will have private sessions for them. But our strategy now is to have people learn together. So we will be having at least quarterly trainings open to the public, but to property managers and government officials and anyone that wants to better understand the fair housing laws.
Attendees at this Newcastle County workshop included leasing agents, property managers, homeowners association representatives, and others considered housing providers. The training outlined protected classes under the Federal Fair Housing Act: race or color, national origin, religion, sex, familial status, and disability. It explained state-level protected classes, including marital status, age, sexual orientation, source of income, and gender identity. The training also asked providers to work through real-life discrimination scenarios division investigators have encountered. Dennis Thompson is on the Architectural Review Board of his Homeowners Association. He went to the training as part of a conciliation agreement after his association denied a resident's request to build a ramp.
We were basing it all based upon our own declaration restrictions and the county code. And as it turned out, the man's wife was disabled, but we didn't know that.
Thompson says Tuesday's training will help his association play a more proactive role in promoting fair housing.
Everybody is now going to be a bit more knowledgeable about what this is all about. We know now better what questions we're going to ask.
Division investigator Inez Hungria says one of the most effective aspects of training is making contact with these housing providers or residents in person.
I love the relationships it builds. So now that he was part of a complaint process, but now he knows who we are. So if something else comes up, he doesn't have to wait for a complaint to be filed. He can call and say, you know, Inez, I have a scenario with an owner. What can we do?
Hungria says the most common area of confusion is protections for individuals with disabilities.
Dealing with persons with disabilities, that comes up a lot, especially when you have these restrictions coming out by municipalities. They'll say, you know, we do not allow this certain breed or a certain weight of animal in our town, and that's fine. But what happens is when a person needs it, or the gentleman I was just talking about where he said, you know, they wanted to put a ramp and we don't allow it to go all the way to the sidewalk. No one has that. Well, this person needs it in order to enjoy an area of their home. So it should be allowed. So, you know, that whole conversation between both parties, we always try to come to some agreement. But there is nothing specific that stands out in my head that says, you know what, this area constantly receives complaints. Now, normally when there's a potential or some type of violation, so let's say, for instance, person with disabilities are not getting their accommodations granted or their modifications granted in an area or a complex or within a management company. So that where you may get a few complaints because the management company who's up above is not allowing these accommodations to take place, and then you might get a couple, you might get two, especially if they own property throughout the state. So you'll get a management company who is doing the same thing in New Castle County, in Sussex County, in Kent County, and then we'll say, wait a minute, how is this pattern going? Because we keep looking at the owner and their management company, and their management company is doing the same thing. And so then we start looking at a pattern of practice. So it's not just by race or whatever. It's that management company who is not applying the law correctly. So then we deal with those situations. But it's not like a certain area we know what's happening over here. There's a nexus. Normally there's a nexus between why it's happening.
Hungria notes the division has noticed a pattern in who might be afraid to report housing discrimination against them.
Undocumented residents. I mean, they tend to be fearful of the law, period, but they are free to file their complaint through our agency. And even if they're fearful of filing a complaint, the commission can file the complaint. We would just need to know the information behind it and what's going on in order for us to pick up the complaint and file it. So even if someone says, you know what, I'm willing to, you know, tell you where the information is or tell you what's going on here and the who's and the what's and the how's, but I don't want to file a complaint because I'm undocumented. Please bring us that information and we will build that case within the division, and we can actually recommend that the commission initiate a complaint. And at that point, the commission can take the complaint by themselves without the complainant. Now, we can also then, after the complaint is filed, identify other aggrieved individuals that have documentation that are here legally and can actually be benefactors to the actual alleged discrimination. So, I mean, again, if someone's fearful because they're undocumented, don't think that you have to live in that type of housing or be subjected to discrimination in Delaware because you're undocumented.
Division Director Ramona Fullman points to another reason people may fear reporting housing discrimination.
The lack of affordable housing, right? So people hesitate to complain because they need a place to live, right? And so they don't want to do anything to jeopardize that living opportunity.
Hungary says the division is happy to consult with individuals or housing providers for free and without risk of a violation being triggered just from talking with division staff.
If on its face it looks like it's a violation, I would say, yeah, you violated their rights. And they, a lot of times, they'll go back and say, okay, you know what, Inez, you know, I'm going to call the tenant and I'm going to fix this. I said, that's great. I mean, hopefully that resident doesn't find out before, but, you know, we want them to learn.
Natalie Fountain, Education and Outreach Coordinator with the division.
We don't want to gotcha. We want them to do the right thing all the time. You know, and so providing guidance and providing education, we hope, is a way to help them do the right thing all the time.
But there are consequences for housing providers who engage in discriminatory practices. Providers can be fined civil penalties ranging from $10,000 to $50,000 if discrimination cases are handled through administrative hearing, or up to $100,000 per violation if brought to superior court. That's on top of damages that can be paid to the aggrieved individual. Division Director Ramona Fullman.
There is a process, and there are penalties that if you're not getting it, or if you are, you know, persisting with doing it the wrong way, if it continues to that you're not providing the effective remedies, you may be back before the commission again, the administrative hearing process.
Several housing providers with Buccini Paulin in Wilmington attended Tuesday's training. Robin Kottman is one of their leasing agents.
Times are always changing, so we need to be relevant on what we can say and what we can't say, because a lot of things are, you know, sensitive these days.
Inez Hungria adds, attending trainings regularly is a good idea for housing providers.
This fair housing law is a living, breathing document. It's ever changing. It's constantly being added to and constantly being changed. So to get the updates, whether it be 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, it should always be something that is behind housing providers to say, you know what, let me get an update on fair housing just to make sure there are no new things that are coming out or that happen or that HUD implemented that we should be aware of, because in a matter of a year, you could be out of compliance by not adding a protected class to your documentation or knowing that there's another possible violation that could exist.
Education and Outreach Coordinator Natalie Fountain says most Division of Human Relations staff have experienced discrimination, so enforcing fair housing law is personal.
I have faced discrimination in housing 30 or so, 35 years or so ago, you know, blatant discrimination by a housing provider in a new development complex. And so did not know what I had dealt with. If I knew then what I know now, I might have gotten a nice big house out of it. But, you know, knowledge is power. And so, you know, the passion around this is nobody should have to deal with discrimination.
Division staff encourage anyone who thinks they may have been discriminated against to contact the division.
Call, go online, or come in. And we have offices in each county. We have a website, and we have a toll-free number.
877-54-HUMAN.
That's Ramona Fullman, Natalie Fountain, and Inez Hungria with the State Division of Human Relations. And I'm Sophia Schmidt with Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. And The Green continues with another candidate conversation in the race for state treasurer. That's after a look at your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we conclude our series of candidate conversations, part of Delaware Public Media's 2018 election coverage and the Delaware debates we're producing again this fall with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. We've reached out to all candidates running in statewide races and invited them to sit down with us for an interview. Candidates in each race are asked the same set of questions to allow you to get to know them and compare them. In addition to airing these interviews on The Green, they'll be available at DelawarePublic.org and DelawareDebates.org right through Election Day in November. Today, we finish our look at the race for state treasurer. Incumbent Republican Ken Simpler is being challenged by Democrat Colleen Davis and the Green Party's David Chandler. We heard from Simpler and Davis last week on The Green. This week, we turn to the Green Party's David Chandler. Here is our candidate conversation with David Chandler. Well, first off, we'll ask, as we do with each candidate, why are you running for state treasurer?
Well, I'm running for state treasurer both to promote the Green Party and also because I believe the state treasurer has an important role in sitting on the State Board of Pardons. The State Board of Pardons has the power to commute sentences with the approval of the governor, and the state treasurer is one of five members. The others being the lieutenant governor, the state auditor, the secretary of state, and the state chancellor. So Delaware has a problem with a huge number of people incarcerated. Mm-hmm. the highest of any state controlled by the Democrats and the highest in the Northeast, and almost twice as many as per capita as in New Jersey. So I believe that we should be looking at a lot of these people for early release. Right. And I would say that I am able to handle the job of the actual Treasury.
Well, and building on that, you know, how does your experience, particularly your professional experience, make you the best candidate for state treasurer?
Well, I think the Republican Party is a mess. So I don't know how my incumbent opponent feels about the situation in Washington, but I think it's just deplorable. And the Democratic Party is not the party of peace. The Democratic Party is consistently voting for military expenditures. Recent vote on the defense budget went 93-7, and the seven that voted against didn't include any Democrats, although it did include Bernie Sanders. So I'm not going to say that my Democratic opponent for the treasurer is somebody that's a warmonger, and she seems to be a very nice person, but I am more qualified than her.
Okay. In previous races, we've seen some candidates emphasize the state treasurer being a financial manager, others an economic watchdog. How do you view the treasurer's office and its role?
Well, certainly you do have a role as a watchdog because you want to stop corruption. Mm-hmm. But mostly that is the job of the auditor. Mm-hmm. So the treasurer has to be somebody that will be honest and look for any discrepancies. But I think most of what goes through the treasurer's office is basically automatic. Their receipts and their expenditures, and then you have to invest the money, which is actually more or less controlled by the Cash Reserve Management Board.
Mm-hmm. The current state auditor, Ken Simpler, during his first term in office, had been a strong advocate for the budget smoothing process, which would force lawmakers to limit spending in good years, save that extra net revenue for years that are much more tight budget-wise. Lawmakers shelved the constitutional amendments to create a process to do that last session, but Governor John Carney signed an executive order to move some portions of the concept forward. My question to you is, should lawmakers revisit that constitutional amendment, which would eliminate the rainy day fund and create a new budget stabilization fund, something that can only be done with that amendment?
No, I don't believe that we should have a constitutional amendment, but in principle, budget smoothing is a good idea. So as far as the budget, I think we need to reorder our priorities. So, for instance, education should be a main priority, and it should be more than it is now, funded by the state government, not through local taxes, which create a burden on the poorer parts of the state. And in general, like the best form of taxation is a progressive tax, which would be the income tax, which I believe also should be made more progressive like it was in the past.
Mm-hmm. Are there some other issues you feel the treasurer can or should take a significant role in advocating for?
Well, I think not so much, no. I think the treasurer has his constitutional duties, and I can advocate in general in political terms. Mm-hmm. But the treasurer doesn't have an actual responsibility to help people manage their own personal budgets, which is I don't think so.
Okay. I'm sure a lot of people don't completely understand the state treasurer's role in managing and investing the state's cash portfolio, as you mentioned earlier. How would you explain it to the average voter and why it's an important part of this job?
Well, it's an important thing that this money does get transferred where it's supposed to go. And so as far as I know, there's been no problem in the last 4 years as far as maintaining that. If somebody's been stealing money, it's not like directly out of the treasurer's office.
Our thanks to David Chandler, Green Party candidate for state treasurer, for his time on The Green this week. Next on The Green, the latest edition of our arts playlist. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Mélomanie, the Delaware music ensemble known for its pairing of Baroque and contemporary styles, celebrates its 26th season with a launch party and concert this weekend. The event will feature the Delaware premiere of two pieces, Hubble's Eye by Christopher Cook and Café au Triolet by Cynthia Folio. Adding to the performance of Hubble's Eye will be an accompanying video projection of photos taken by the Hubble Deep Space Telescope. In this week's arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Mélomanie co-artistic director Tracy Richardson.
Talk to me about your new season.
Well, thank you. We are going to begin our new season pretty soon. It will be on Sunday, October 7th at 3 o'clock here in Wilmington at the Delaware Historical Society. And we're going to be playing in the historic building there, the Old Town Hall, that's been renovated beautifully. And as you said, we like to, and we always do in our concerts, play provocative pairings of early and contemporary works, meaning we play Baroque music. You know, that's the music from 1600 to 1750 approximately, on period instruments. And then we skip over to the 20th century and play music that's written for our ensemble from the 20th century and also the most current century, our 21st. We have about 50 pieces that composers, contemporary composers, have written for us or parts of our ensemble. And so we, in every concert, like to put these two together. And we think it's, and our audience thinks it's very stimulating and interesting to hear music from the time very far from us and the music of now.
Talk to me a little bit about the background before we continue about the new season that's getting ready to launch. Talk to me about the background of the group.
Well, thank you. The co-artistic director and I, Kim Raley, is the co-artistic director. We go back about 26 years, and we founded Mélomanie way back when we got to know each other, and we decided we would get together in my home because I'm the harpsichordist in the group. And Kim is the flutist. And we would read Baroque music once a week and, you know, maybe do some concerts. And we really hit it off, and we've been best, you know, we've been very good friends since then. And we founded a group, and first it had three members, and then it had, different personnel over the many years. But Kim Raley and I are the co-artistic directors and the core of it. And eventually, in addition to the Baroque music, we started adding some modern or contemporary pieces, meaning, you know, contemporary classical pieces. And we really enjoyed it, and our composer friends started writing for us, and we started programming those pieces. The audience that we were playing for seemed really to like it, and we knew we did. So that's what we have become, because we all in our group play what we call period instruments, you know, instruments from the Baroque time. They could be antique instruments or they could be reproductions. And then we play modern instruments as well. And those are very different for the string players and the flutist. For the harpsichordist, it's not as different. But anyway, that's what we do. And currently we have a five-member core ensemble, and they're Kimberly Raley, the flutist, Christoph Richter, violinist, Donna Fournier, viola da gamba, Ismar Gomez, cellist, and I'm the harpsichordist.
How long have you been playing the harpsichord?
Oh, boy. I've been playing it since I was about 19 years old.
So music kind of hits at your soul, Tracy?
Well, I think you have to say it that way. Yes, it grabs you. For me, I don't know. I've been doing music. I've been taking music lessons since I was a little child in the second grade. And you don't realize it, but it's just taking over in your mind and in your soul, as you say. And then you go from there.
All right. Talk about how people can get tickets to come to your new season.
People can get tickets by going onto our website and clicking tickets. And our website is our name, melomanie.org. I'm going to spell melomanie, melomanie.org. And it's a French word. It's a real French word. It means you can translate it the love of music or music mania. Otherwise, people can come and buy a ticket at the door. And where they're going to come is the Delaware Historical Society in Wilmington. We're at 505 North Market Street, and the zip there is 19801. So I hope people will come. May I tell you what we're going to play?
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, sticking with our provocative pairings, we're going to have two Delaware premieres of pieces. One is Hubble's Eye by Dr. Christopher Cook. He's going to come up from Chowan University in North Carolina. And Hubble's Eye is a set of seven miniature musical pieces that were inspired by images photographed from the Hubble Deep Space Telescope. So we're going to be projecting those images so that the audience can see them. And so that's our first piece, Hubble's Eye, and that's for flute, violin, gamba, and harpsichord. The other Delaware premiere is called Café au Triolet, and that's by Philadelphia composer Dr. Cynthia Folio. She's at Temple University, where she, you know, is professor of composition and theory, and I don't think she's a professor of flute, but she's an expert flutist. And that piece is for flute, violin, and harpsichord. And she wrote it several years ago for another group, and now we're going to play it as a Delaware premiere. And we're going to play two Baroque pieces. One is by the great French Baroque composer François Couperin, and it's called La Sultane. And that is for the whole ensemble. And then our two bass instruments, the viola da gamba and the cellist, will play a sonata by Jean-Daniel Braun. And because we are playing in our, you know, kind of our new venue at the Delaware Historical Society, we are all going to play a get-to-know-you solo. So we'll have just short solos by everyone in the ensemble, just to say hello and so that people can get to know us at our new venue. So that's what we're going to be playing as usual, provocative pairings of early and contemporary works. And because this is our first, our first launch, we're calling it Melomanie Launch Party and Concert, and that concert starts at 3 o'clock. But before that, at 2 o'clock, we hope audience members will come for a special wine and cheese reception and guided tours of the museum, plus a wine tasting by a local wine distributor called Swig, who are putting on a wine tasting for us. So come at 2 o'clock. You can have a nice pre-concert treat and have guided tours of the museum.
Thanks to Melomanie, co-artistic director Tracy Richardson, and R. Kelly Steele for their time in this week's Arts Playlist. There's more information on Melomanie and its upcoming season starting this weekend at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Kelly Steele rejoins us next with Enlighten Me and a look at what DelDOT is doing to help suicide prevention in the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware's Department of Transportation is joining suicide prevention efforts in the first state. DelDOT now has suicide prevention signs on five Newcastle County bridges,
hoping to deter anyone who may be considering taking his or her own life. The signs were the brainchild of State Representative Valerie Longhurst. Deldon officials and Representative Longhurst hope that a person considering suicide will reconsider and reach out for help, and these signs offer information on how to do that. For this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with DelDOT Communications Director C.R. McLeod and State Representative Valerie Longhurst about these signs and about the help that is out there for anyone who may be considering taking their own life.
C.R., let's talk about these suicide prevention signs that have been erected by DelDOT. What's this all about?
Well, earlier this year, Representative Valerie Longhurst had actually come to the department and asked us if we would be able to look at adding some of these signs to area bridges in support of suicide prevention awareness. And September was actually Suicide Prevention Month, and the department did go out over the past couple of weeks and has now installed five new suicide prevention signs on five Newcastle County bridges, which include the Tyler McConnell Bridge on 141, the I-95 Brandywine River Bridge, and the I-495 Christina River Bridge, as well as two other bridges that were identified in the process as well. So really just wanting to put further notice up out there. If someone is considering this, we're hoping that the signs will help them possibly reconsider and reach out for help.
C.R., have these five bridges over the years seen instances of suicide?
Yes, occasionally they have, and these bridges were identified because of their height. They are high bridges in the area, and working with our engineers as well as talking with some of the local suicide prevention agencies that do outreach, we really thought that these would be the most ideal locations to add these signs to these bridges as well. Previously, the Army Corps of Engineer had added these exact same signs on the St. George's Bridge and the Roth Bridge over the C&D Canal. So, again, just looking at how can we, put another message out there with some information, hopefully, preventing anyone from really taking a drastic measure. So it's something that we thought was an easy to do that would help, again, just to draw awareness and support efforts to prevent suicide.
How are these signs being funded? How much did they cost?
They came out of the department has its own sign shop here, so there was no cost incurred for this, which was great. Again, we have our own in-house sign shop, so again, this was all done just by DelDOT employees and installed by our staff as well. So again, this was an easy one for us to do that we thought would help in the efforts to prevent anyone from possibly considering suicide. Unfortunately, in 2017, there were over 100 suicides in Delaware, so it is a problem and one that we want to do our part to hopefully try and prevent that.
You mentioned the height of these bridges. Which one is the tallest and how tall?
The tallest bridge where we've installed this would be the 495 Christina River Bridge right near the Port of Wilmington, obviously to allow boats to go under that as well. And that one is it's over 100 feet high. I don't have the exact measurement off the top of my head, but so that's probably the highest one in the area. Obviously, the 95 Brandywine River Bridge is another one that is it has some significant height to it as well. So again, we're just being mindful of identifying spots that someone might consider that and trying to put another message out there to prevent that from happening.
Let's bring in State Representative Valerie Longhurst, who spearheaded the erection of these signs. Why?
Well, I spearheaded it because I've had a lot to do with suicide prevention in the state of Delaware. I've drafted legislation to put programs in all the schools for training for all staff members. This is an epidemic that just keeps continually to grow, and I feel it's important that we address it because of the mental health issues that we have in the state of Delaware. And about last year, I'm an avid cyclist, and I was riding my bike over the St. George's Bridge. And when I rode over the St. George's Bridge, I noticed a sign, a suicide prevention sign, that had a 1-800 number that says, "We're here to help you. Please call in if you feel like, that you don't have any other alternative. And so when I got back from my bike ride, I called DelDOT and asked if it was on all the bridges. Unfortunately, you know, they had to go and search it. They had it on some of the major bridges, but they didn't have it on all the bridges. So I put a request in to have it placed on every single bridge. You know, if we're going to do this, we need to do it full force. And I'm excited that DelDOT has taken that step to put those signs on five new bridges. So it's a step in the right direction for Delaware to help prevent suicide.
Representative, in 2017, there were over 100 lives lost to suicide in Delaware. Do you feel as a society we fail too often to recognize the signs of mental illness?
I think it's an awareness. I think that it's starting to elevate because we are recognizing it more and more every day. With the mental health crisis that we have on our hands, it's a key component to it, to understanding and stopping and listening to people. Sometimes our society moves too quickly and we're not paying attention to our loved ones. And, you know, I'm hoping that these signs do reach people that feel like there's nobody listening to them, that they have an opportunity to speak to somebody. And I think we're moving in that direction. Just like with anything else, sometimes we move slower than we want to, but this has been a top priority of me to continue to move that bar in the state of Delaware because every life does matter, and it's a grave concern of mine, and I'm hoping that this is just another step that we're facing in the state of Delaware to say, you do matter. We do have help. Getting that number out there, making sure that people know that it's available, it's just a tragedy, especially when you see young children taking their lives.
As a prominent member of the legislature here in Delaware, do you have any other things in the works to help members, not members, but people suffering from mental illness, people that are thinking about taking their lives?
I do. I do have a piece of legislation that I'm working, that I've been working with DSCA now for the last 6 months. So in January or February, I'm hoping to put forth some mental health legislation that I think will help at the elementary level. So stay tuned for that. I don't want to share too much of it until I work out all the kinks, but I do have legislation that I will be bringing forward next year.
Thanks to DelDOT's C.R. McLeod, State Representative Valerie Longhurst, and our Kelly Steele for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.